Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Open Paddock Podcast, episode 195 for July 9th, 2013, where we're going to talk about IndyCar's return to Pocono, as well as the Mazda Road to Indy at Pocono. And we'll talk about Formula One, the Pirelli tire debacle, as well as the results from this past weekend's German Grand Prix.
Higher performance and faster and more reliable.
You are listening to the Open Paddock Podcast, bringing you the finest in rally, Formula One, IndyCars, Mazda Road to Indy, sports cars, and other news from all around the world of motorsports. Now, here is your hosts, Sean, Mike, Doug, Mike, and Kevin.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. After the short and brief intro there with the really cool techno dance music from Kevin, I would like to welcome everybody to the show. So joining us tonight, we have Doug.
Hello.
We have Mike W.
Hi.
We have Kevin.
I get me brain medicine from the National Health.
And I don't know what just happened there. And we have the intern. Hello, Mr. Shaw.
Good evening.
Kevin has found a stash of bath salts.
Nice. Yeah, exactly.
Can you hold on a minute? I'm not done eating this face yet.
Oh my.
Where did the skin come from on my arm?
Disgusting. Well, we've got a lot to talk about tonight, so we're going to power through as quick as we possibly can, while also giving insightful analysis and opinion. And
before we jump into anything, I would like to take one serious moment here and send condolences to friend of the show, Bree Rentz. You may know her as the PR girl for Dreyer and Reinbold or from ALMS Chicks, but her father died the other day, actually. So yeah. Condolences to Bree.
Yeah, I did see that. So very sad, but again, at the same time, I guess a little bit of relief and closure in a pretty tough chapter there. So, but yeah, definitely sympathies go out to the fam. Let's talk about we haven't done beverage roll call yet, so we'll do beverage roll call quickly here. Tonight I have, first off, about a quarter of a bottle of Red's Apple Ale left. I had to try it after all the hype that I've been hearing about it, and it's meh, pretty good. I don't see all the hype, but it's a good drink. And then to follow it up and do the grand finale for the show, we have a triple Finlandia and orange juice.
I tell you, that Red Apple Ale,
uh-huh.
You need to have that after you spend about 2 hours on the mower at 100 degree heat. Mm. And that will be like divine nectar. It will be ambrosia.
And wow. Also, if it's the only decent drink they serve at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, aside from Bud Light and Foster's,
you don't like getting yourself a big old oil can?
I like
well,
the oil
and,
can.
And then also, if you're way too far away from that Jaeger tent, right there behind the pagoda, that's also a... Anyway.
As an Australian friend of mine once told me, Foster's, Australian for tourists.
Yes, Anyway, I have no drink to report this evening. However, I am the proud owner of 3.5 full liters of Bombay Sapphire Gin, which I procured from Costco in Chicago. I'm quite happy with that purchase because it was super dirt cheap.
Well played, sir. Well played.
Next we'll go with Doug. Doug, what do you have?
Sir, you would be very proud of me.
Yes.
I am having a vodka and dry vermouth cocktail.
Better known as a martini.
Yeah, no. Sorry, I'm with Doug on this one. Proper martini's gin.
Yep. It is a tasty cocktail, but that is exactly what you call it.
we'll use flavorless vodka and throw in a little vermouth and call it a martini because nobody understands what liquor is.
Hey, it gets you drunk.
It does.
All right,
it dulls the pain of a long day.
Kevin?
I am tonight I'm practicing for when I finally win the Indianapolis 500.
Mm. Nice.
Buttermilk?
Buttermilk is good for one thing, sir, and that is cooking.
All right.
I've got a nice big glass of the 2% right here.
Good choice. Nice. Good choice. And Shaw.
I am taking a little bit of your lead there. I got some vodka this last week. Keeping it local, Portland potato vodka, which, you know, if you think about it, potatoes around here are pretty big deal. Orida potatoes, Oregon, Idaho. We have obviously lots of potatoes here, so. They make a vodka that's so darn good. I did your limonada with vodka, and it's delicious. And that was so good, the vodka, that I ended up having to have a shot on the side just to drink it a little bit straight. Because I keep it on ice, of course.
You've got a little Greek action going there, man. Some lemon potatoes.
Nice.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So as you see, my influence is slowly spreading over the show. Doug has a vodka-tini, and Mr. Shaw, the intern, has a limonada with vodka, so I'm slowly taking over.
I've loved limonada for years. I just never thought of mixing it. And, brilliant combo.
I'm just waiting for everybody on the show to have a little of that Three Olives dude.
That is so wrong. So wrong.
Never, ever, ever are vodka allowed to parse these lips.
But I will say that it does sound like Shaw needs a little dude in his mouth. Oh!
Ooh. Oh, no, 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 no. Oh, no.
Oh,
oh
no. PG-13, my friend.
Good night, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. No, I had to say it. White, so he opened the door. He served the softball. I couldn't let it sit. That's like getting struck out looking at a fastball right across the plate. I mean, you just can't live with yourself after that. But
so how about that IndyCar in Pocono?
There's Pocono to talk about.
Pocono. Pocono's awesome. Yes,
yeah. Well, yeah, we actually did finally, after what seemed like a lifetime of waiting, the IndyCars finally returned to Pocono for the first time since 1989. And we can actually thank a person who had a lot to do with that, who actually was putting out some fantastic coverage for us over the weekend, Mr. Spike Rogan. Spike, good sir, I want to say thank you, not only for putting together fantastic content for us all weekend, because it was great. I was reading it and following it while I was back home again in Indiana. And
have to throw out a shout out to Spike Rogan.
Yes.
If you've been listening to Trackside the last few weeks, they've referred to him as Sticks Rogan.
Mm. Oh, sad.
Sticks? Really? Sticks or something like that. It decidedly was not Spike.
Yeah. Well, for those of you who don't know, Mr. Rogan, who used to actually write quite a bit for us, he's actually really busy with a lot of school and being involved with his local community,
got a real freaking job.
Yeah, he does. Constable he's quite busy. But he did a fantastic job and really spearheaded bringing the IndyCars back to Pocono. Played a big role in trying to make that happen. And it finally did. And it all culminated in this weekend as being what I thought, anyways, was a fantastic show. I really enjoyed it. I know that I didn't necessarily watch. I listened to it on Sirius XM. The IndyCar or the Indianapolis Motor Speedway radio guys did a fantastic job covering the race. I was just slightly disappointed with the outcome, but, you know, tis the life of being a fanboy of a name that is constantly cursed. But it was a fantastic event, and some of the issues, we had a lot of issues actually crop up, that being with tire testing and even some of the practice on the aero kit.
If you recall, they tested their package back in April at Pocono when it was like cold.
Yeah, it was like what, 50s, 60s?
Yeah, so when they came to do a practice the week before the race, they're like, yeah, this is not gonna work. So they went away from using the Indy rubber, and they went away from the aero kit they were planning on, or the aero setup they were planning on using, and had to tweak it quite a bit to get it usable for Pocono.
Yeah. It was an interesting test that it yielded, but we did see in practice and qualifications, yet again for well, for every oval we've had this year, pretty much. It appeared as though that Marco Andretti was going to be the car to beat. If not Marco Andretti, it looked to be like it was going to be a Andretti Autosport car nonetheless, as they dominated the practice. The Hondas looked like they were kind of off kilter a little bit, as they have been all year during practice. And then we moved into qualifying as well, where it was much the same, where we had the qualifications happen. Marco Andretti took pole rather convincingly, might I add, by a few tenths over Ryan Hunter-Reay, and then James Hinchcliffe, another Andretti Autosport car on the outside. Also, it was a top six lockout for Chevrolet before you got to Scott Dixon, who was in a Honda, Sato's Honda, and then Pagano's Honda, kind of rounded out the top 10 with DiSilvestro actually putting up a really good, top 10 start there. So I was pretty impressed with that, given the fact that I've come out a couple of times and the last few weeks and kind of said, you know, I think she's kind of regressing a bit here. And she made up for it with a solid top 10 start at this race. So outside of that, other notables, James Jakes, 14th, kind of a little bit of a regress in his current form. Ed Carpenter, we also had, Ed Carpenter was 15th, which is kind of unusual considering his prowess on ovals. Franchitti was all the way back in 18th. Pippa Mann was 19th in the Coin Honda, well off the pace, as was Sebastian Saavedra. And then some guys who didn't set times, Viso didn't set times because he hit the wall actually rather hard. And then Briscoe, he started at the back because he was not there for the, he was not there for qualifications, so they opted to start in the back. And then Herta and Tagliani bringing up the rear of the field. So really nothing special that we've seen in qualifications. Solid qualifying. TK, we should note.
I would like to point out once again that James Jakes out-qualified Graham Rahal.
And out-finished him.
Indeed. Well, we also
by a bit.
I'm not surprised, so I'll go ahead and throw that up there. But Tony Kanaan, we should mention, started fifth. His importance, along with being a pretty damn good oval driver, he was the contestant for the Triple Crown, the Fuzzy Zavaca Triple Crown that we've been monitoring after taking victory in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
We have?
So
we have, yes. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Kind of like we're keeping an eye on that Foyt trophy, too.
Yeah, I like the idea of the Triple Crown. I don't really like the idea of its separate trophies, but I do like the Triple Crown. I think if properly marketed, and I like that Fuzzies has taken the lead with it, I think it can be a big hit if anybody gets close to taking the victory or taking the Triple Crown. I think we can build a lot of hype around that, a lot of positive hype in the press. So I do like the Triple Crown. I don't much like the other ones.
One other thing to point out about qualifying, too. Justin Wilson qualified down there in 20th place. His crew horribly missed the setup on his car during practice. They put the wrong gearing in, and every time he would come out of the pit lane, he would hit the rev limiter pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So his qualifying speed was based on a general idea of a setup that Coin had.
And we saw how that worked. Never, yeah. Note to self, never take general setup that that Coin thinks he has.
Oh, but here's the thing. That speed that he ran on his qualifying run was 10 miles an hour faster than his practice times.
Oh, wow.
That's a significant improvement.
Yeah, I reckon so. So, yeah, it was a great run, nonetheless, for Andretti Autosport, taking out the front row. And Marco again showing just how much better he's doing this year and really showing his abilities on the oval, as he's been a factor at every oval we've been to, at least heading into the race. Go ahead.
Has he?
Yeah, he has.
Did you really consider him a factor?
Yeah. At Indianapolis, he had really fast times. At Milwaukee, he had good times. At Iowa, he had the dominant times until he got a box for the neutrals. And then at Pocono, he dominated the times all weekend. And really, for the most part, like the first half of the race, until fuel mileage came into play. And then he was no longer, that was a classic example of the fastest car on track, not necessarily winning. So, but yes, I will say that he has been a factor at all the ovals that we've been to. Now, at the road courses, it's been slightly debatable. He's been, you know, he's been meh. I'll say he hasn't done anything special, but on ovals, I think that he's done very well. And just had a lot of bad luck. I mean, he's an Andretti. It happens.
I think that Marco eats like a bag of caramel before every oval race because he chokes.
I don't agree with that. I think he's such a much more mature driver this year. I don't think that bears fruit at all.
I don't much care for the choke. And I'll speak from this from an objective standpoint here. And that is, if you look at Iowa, well, look at Indianapolis. We can go to Indianapolis and take a look. Indianapolis, he was good. He always is good at Indianapolis, or is reasonable, I guess I should say, at least in the race. Obviously, we had the qualifying blunders of a couple years ago, but, I mean, he ran good at Indianapolis, put up a lot of really good times, and he was battling with TK for most of the race. At the end, he did kind of botch the restart and got swallowed up by a few cars, and then the other cautions that came out didn't really help his cause. But if you look at Milwaukee, it was reasonable. If you look at Iowa, he dominated Iowa until, like I said, his car busted. And then you look at Pocono, he dominated all the way up until the race. And it wasn't that he choked, it was the fact
it was
that
the team.
It goes beyond the team. The fact of the matter is Chevrolet has by far the quickest engine between them and Honda. But with that power, you're giving up a lot of fuel mileage. And unfortunately, the strategy that the team employed did not really take into good account the fuel mileage as well. They were kind of hoping for maybe a couple more cautions. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is he had the fastest car. He dominated the race until the end when he needed to be there. And that was no fault of his ability behind the wheel as much as it was the fact that the Chevrolet engine as a whole was actually vastly inferior when it came to sipping the fuel. And what you know just as much as anyone else, when you start talking about 400 and 500 mile races, it kind of comes into these fuel situations, especially on wide tracks like that where there's not as many cautions, especially at Pocono. So if you're relying on those cautions to play to your strategy, you probably have made a mistake already in doing that, because you should know that there's not going to be many cautions at a wide track like that.
There's one thing I'll say, though. Marco, yes, he has matured a lot over the season and in the off season, but there's one problem that still lingers with him, and that's when things aren't going perfect for him, he tends to kind of lose it.
He does get a little jumpy and does get a little mad. I guess I can understand his frustrations. I think there's other ways to go about it. But then again, I would also say, well, you know, you look at some of these drivers like Franchitti, who's had terrible luck, or lack of skill or something the last couple years. I mean, he's just not had it. That's frustrating. You listen to Will Power and all the bad luck that Will Power has. And, you know, I understand. And yes, he does have tantrums, when things don't go right. But, you know, I don't know if that's just chalk that up to being a racing driver, or if that's chalking up the fact that he just doesn't know how to deal with the stress. I don't know.
I'd chalk it up to the fact that he's, what, like 25, 26 years old? He's still a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Very true.
Yeah, true that.
So, speaking of waiting for the yellow flags, boy, you didn't even get outside of the first lap for the first one.
Well, yeah, James Hinchcliffe rolling, and I compared it. I said, oh my, I was driving in the car, lap one, turn one, Hinchcliffe goes from being, P3 to being P26 in the wall. So it was a really good opportunity for me to reminisce when Scott Sharp took pole position at Indianapolis Motor Speedway and wadded it up in turn one. That's immediately what I thought of when it happened. And I was just like, I mean, granted, he wasn't on pole position, but he's on the front row nonetheless. And, so Hinchcliffe had a terrible opening turn there. When they asked him what had happened, he just said, I don't really know. I went into the turn and all of a sudden I had massive oversteer, and I saved it once, but I couldn't save it twice.
Twitter quote of the day, James Hinchcliffe, instead of being Hinch or Hinchtown, should change his name to Hinchy Bobby, because if he ain't first, he's last.
Oh, wow. I like
ain't
it.
Ain't that the truth this year?
Oh, that was a bad one.
And, you know, it's all been for the better for the broadcast team.
Right.
Truth. Yeah, the broadcast team has benefited greatly from his appearance in the booth.
When he got up in the booth and he started, you know, basically talking over Scott Goodyear and Doofenshmirtz or whatever his name is.
Oh
I'll tell you, it was poetic when he started talking over Cheever and Goodyear, because he just started filling their airwaves with good information delivered in really a professional tone and cadence that this guy carries. I mean, it's really good to see.
But honestly, there hasn't been a better person up in the booth since when Dan Weldon would be able to come up there. Anyways, you know, my wife actually was watching because I, you know, DVR'd it and watched it later. And my wife was watching with me. And as soon as Hinch came on, suddenly she was interested in watching what was going on.
Yeah.
On all, she doesn't care much about IndyCar. She really doesn't. She watches a little bit with me and she knows the big names. But when Hinch got in the booth, she's like, I totally understand everything he was saying.
Yeah.
You know? Well, I mean, it's just, he also showed up on the IMS broadcast as good. Well. So I was following the Twitter, and they're like, Hinch is in the booth, hooray! And I'm like, bummer. But I mean, you know, Mike King and the guys did a fantastic job, obviously, in the booth. And then, in the booth for the Indianapolis guys. And then to have Hinch in there just even made it that much better to follow when he was there. I mean, I was like, this is great, yeah. Man. And I had it turned up so loud. My kids are like, Daddy, we can't hear our iPods. I was like, shut up!
Hinch in the booth is like if Michael Waltrip wasn't a complete window licker and you actually enjoyed listening to him.
The fact that you just compared Hinchcliffe.
I almost understood what you meant there.
Just ignore me.
Never compare him again.
Yeah.
The
sad thing about the Hinch wreck is it didn't let the three wide start develop. We immediately went to single file start. So the three wide start looked pretty and didn't develop, and we didn't get to see the results of it really. So too bad.
What about Takuma Sato, like practicing for the next demolition derby at your local short track?
I was really hoping he'd come and say, yeah, my brakes just failed. And no, they didn't.
No,
he just screwed up royally.
Yeah. The term I use for it is Sutil Ralphs over Ryan Hunter Ray.
he did. Full mount.
Yeah.
Full mount.
If this were the Olympics, would we say he successfully completed a half Hildebrand?
Yeah. The last time I saw that maneuver, Tony Kanaan was getting out profusely thanking Elio Castroneves for saving his life.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this time it was Ryan Hunter Ray wondering what the hell just happened.
Exactly, yeah.
It was just shocking. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it.
Given the way that Sato's performed this year, and really years leading up the last couple seasons, he's performed marvelously. And this, unfortunately...
Well, he was in the top five.
Well, yeah.
A complete brain fart.
Yeah, it's a regret.
Takuma Sato.
He basically regressed to his rookie season.
Yeah, what they talked about on the broadcast was, you know, these carbon brakes, you have to warm them up, and you have to be aware of that as a driver. You can't come into pit lane and step on the brakes and expect them to work. They have to be warmed up down the backstretch before they will actually work. So that's really the reason that everybody's giving this auto just basically brain fart, brain fade, didn't think about it. And when he came onto pit lane, he had to get on the binders and they wouldn't work because they weren't heated already.
Yeah. And coming from Formula One, you would think that perhaps he was a little bit more aware of the carbon brake situation. I'm not sure.
You know, you have to give it to him. The red haze was setting in, you know, the red mist was clouding his eyes. He was seeing, you know, a good result on an oval and just threw it away.
Well, you're thinking he had it under control in Formula One.
Yeah. That's right.
I will give credit where credit's due. I remember when he schooled my boy Michael at Indianapolis that year and passed him for P3. And I was just like, holy God, Sato. I was like, are you serious right now?
Well, let's consider, too, that the fact that Takuma is 5 years removed from his last Formula One season. He's not a Formula One driver anymore. He's an IndyCar driver.
I would reckon that you would think that, you know, the wheels, like riding a bicycle. I mean, you get carbon. He's a racing driver. He's a professional racing driver. Surely he has to be aware that he has carbon brakes, thus bringing him back to the Formula One days. You know, I don't know. It doesn't matter. The fact is, it was a brain fart. It was the dumbest move all year, to be honest, and one of the dumbest moves I've seen in a while. Not in a while. It was dumber. The only thing that I've seen recently that was more ridiculous was when Tagliani punted Hunter Ray. And I hated Tagliani for that for two reasons. It's the fact that he had hit Hunter Ray, who was fighting for the championship, and the fact that I had to hear Hunter Ray bitch afterward. That really was upsetting.
Yeah, kind of a weird situation there. I don't know, man. The sad thing is it looks like Hunter Ray's kind of re-aggravated an injury with his thumb. It's an injury that started at Barber, and he's looking to get an X-ray on his thumb this week because after the race he was wearing a brace on that thumb.
Yeah, and he said he's not looking forward to it at all at Toronto, you know, being as rough of a circuit as Toronto is and having a thumb problem, that's just going to be a bad, bad deal.
Is that the same thumb injury from Indianapolis when Conway went up?
This was the one that he suffered at Barber, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. And I want to say it was re-aggravated at Indianapolis.
Could have been.
The thumb that never heals.
Yeah, true. Terrible bone structure or something. You need to get that checked out. You need to drink more milk. Oh, that was. Yeah, interesting stuff and tough for Hunter Ray, but we'll see how that goes out. So, but let's see. We've got, let's get into the rest of the race because what ended up happening was we didn't have many caution flags there towards the end. It was pretty wide open racing for pretty good stints. We had a couple here and there, kind of little miscues. But what ended up happening was the fact that it basically became a fuel mileage race. As we talked about with the 400 and 500 mile races, you tend to get these kinds of situations cropping up, especially on these wide tracks where cautions are in fact less abundant. And that really opened the doors for the Hondas, because while the Hondas lacked outright pace that the Chevrolets had, the Hondas made up for that by having phenomenal fuel mileage. And as we saw, the Ganassi team as a whole, not just Target Chip Ganassi Racing, but also Charlie Kimball, were able to really cash that in and put together a phenomenal result, because we had, you know, we had a Ganassi lockout of the podium with Dixon taking the win.
Well, I've got a quick question, though. I mean, do you guys think that, I mean, it was pretty obvious right from the very first pit stop that strategy-wise, the number of laps left, that there was no way Marco was going to be able to make it to the end. You know, he wasn't going to have enough pit stops to do the strategy other people were doing.
Yeah.
He did his first pit stop 2 to 4 laps before everybody else.
Yeah.
Even other Chevrolets. So the question there is, I'm thinking this was probably a team problem. Could they have leaned him out a little bit earlier on? I mean, he was so dominant, like you said.
Yeah,
I think that's one of the problems. Or the other thing is, could he have pushed harder and done a splash and go and still won it?
I think one of their problems was the fact that they had banked on more cautions during the race than what happened.
Always that roll of the dice, isn't it?
Yeah, and instead of either deciding to try to, I remember Dan Weldon saying one time that the best way to run if you're in a fuel mileage issue is to lean it out at the start of the race and through the middle, and that way you're able to run full throttle at the end.
Exactly.
And I think that's kind of the reverse of what happened with Andretti, was they planned on all those cautions and didn't get them, and that forced them to kind of lean it out at the end.
Yeah, and that was terrible, because there's no reason, really. I mean, if you think about it, the way I would have approached it, and of course, hindsight 2020, everybody's a Monday morning quarterback.
Of course.
But I truly agree with that principle that I, you know, because you look at Andretti, he was leading by a second and a half or a second, and it's like, dude, you don't need to go flat out right now. How about we just, go ahead and take it easy, maybe hang back a little bit. We've got the fastest car. That's obvious. We have the fastest car by a mile, but we also need to talk about maybe leaning it out so that at the end we don't run into one of these problems, because you have to think, I'm not an engineer or anybody who makes decisions, but I just have to think that on these races, just given what I know, you have to kind of plan for these fuel mileage situations. You just have to, because they happen more times than not. And if you're getting that kind of power and running that kind of MPG on your race pace, perhaps you should just kind of chill out a little bit, run, hit your fuel numbers, and then, like you said, Kevin, make that last push at the end of the race and really try to take it at that point. And that, I mean, because obviously nobody cares that you led the first half of the lap or first half of the race. The only thing that people really care about is, hey, did you lead the last lap? Nope. Well, it doesn't matter. Thanks for playing. So, you know, I truly agree with you there. It could have been a team issue with the strategy and then, you know, teamed with the Chevrolet engine guzzling down gas. I mean, they just didn't plan well enough for it, and that's why we had what we had. But Ganassi, on the other hand, was able to seize the opportunity and really make their MPG work. Their drivers, as we know, Scott Dixon and Dario Franchitti, are phenomenal at hitting their fuel numbers. Phenomenal at hitting fuel numbers.
I was about to say, there are no two better drivers in the sport. Maybe in upper level racing today, period, all series, at hitting fuel mileage that they need to hit, than Dario Franchitti and Scott Dixon.
Hmm. Yeah, and Dixon has Franchitti's number this year. It seems like they've got similar equipment, but Dixon seems more comfortable with the car. And Franchitti, I get, you know, Hinch was throwing this out on the broadcast. He said that Franchitti likes a solid back end of the car. He doesn't like it to squirrel around too much. He can drive with oversteer and prefers a car with a little oversteer in it. And they're having trouble making the car do what he wants, where Dixon seems a bit more capable of dealing with whatever the car gives him. Yes. And that's leading to some of their issues this year. But that said, fantastic result for Franchitti. I think this is the best this year for him.
Oh, yeah. By far.
And it's obvious.
By far.
And I'm telling you, watching that after the race, too, it's obvious that all three of those cars are working together. For the way you saw when Dario got out of his car and Charlie got out of his car, they were just like, it was a love fest.
It was a complete team effort. It really was. And, you know, really, hats off to Ganassi. I mean, they really pulled it together. That was a well-structured, well-done win for all of them. It was pretty awesome.
And one of the best parts about this 1-2-3 victory is Charlie Kimball sticking it in Graham's eye one more time.
I was going to ask again, where did Graham finish?
Yeah, Ray Hall finished overall in the 18th position, two laps down.
I've been saying it since they hired Charlie Kimball. That was a great move, hiring Charlie. He didn't get quite the results that you want in lots, but the thing is, you can tell he's a very teachable driver, and he's obviously learning, and he's obviously getting better.
For sure.
Yeah.
Unlike Pippa Rahal.
Oh, jeez. Look out. Off the top rope. After this is what happens. We get no alcohol into White Soul, and he instantly starts blasting people on heroin. Anyways, it was a phenomenal result for Ganassi Racing. Dixon taking the win. I believe that to be his first of the year. Kimball finishing second. Franchitti finishing third. Power finishing a respectable fourth. And Joseph Newgarden, how about that? The Sarah Fisher-Hartman car finishing in the top five. Their best result by far this year. So Power leading the way for Team
Shepard. Where did he finish at Sao Paulo?
That was third, wasn't it?
Oh, fifth.
That's right. He lost a bunch of positions there.
It's definitely their best finish on an oval. But I thought he had gotten a top five earlier this year as well.
Yeah, Sao Paulo.
But still, doesn't take away from the fact that it was a really great result for the team.
Yeah. We look at the race here, and six out of the top 10 cars were actually Honda powered, with the one Will Power finishing in the top five. The rest came at the end of the tail end of the top 10, with Alio finishing eighth, ninth for Ed Carpenter. Really kind of weird day for Ed and the boys there at Ed Carpenter Racing. I expected a little bit more, but I'm not really sure what happened.
They had some pit issues on that last exchange as well, which dropped them back further in the field. So, yeah, there's some consistency issues that really have hampered Ed Carpenter's team.
Yeah.
It's too bad.
What about Kanaan messing it up by doing that pass and messing up his front wing?
He was
on the radio after that, just apologizing profusely to his team owners, because he has a chance to make some good money for the team, and unfortunately just threw it away at this race, because he did have a good car and was making good progress through the field.
Yep, he was making that pass and just clipped that rear, that little bumper, basically, and broke that front wing.
Cardassian.
We won't call it that. We'll call it the opportunistic tire slasher guard.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's talk. Like that description. So that was the end of the race, or pretty much the end of the race there. And the race itself actually did pretty well in the television realm, because we all know as IndyCar fans, the only thing that matters is television ratings. If you don't have them, you're a failure to life. And while I also think that's a load of BS, given today's...
Bernie Eccleston agrees.
I
don't
also...
care if anybody shows up to my races, as long as there are TV cameras and big signs that have my money printed all over them in the wake of sponsors.
Well, I will say this before we get into the numbers, but I will say that I have far more respect and I do far more product shopping when I'm at the track than I do by watching it on TV. Because if you actually have a physical booth that I can visit, and I can actually see your products, and you have a spokesman who speaks well and educated about your product, I like that. I don't give a damn if your car has sponsorship on the car and it's on television. I don't care, because what do I get out of that? Oh, look at that pretty car. I don't actually see what your product can do. Whereas if I'm actually at the track, I can sample an RC Cola. I can have some Fuzzy's vodka.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
Yes,
if I go to
you
Indianapolis,
can.
I most certainly can have Fuzzies.
In Indianapolis.
Well, that's like the one race I've been to all year, so yes, it matters.
That's the only race that really matters.
Well, it does. So, I mean, as Shaw points out, the sponsors do care about the TV coverage, and that's great. I mean, I'm glad they do, but I don't think that that should be the be-all, end-all of anything, because, again, I, as a consumer, would far rather see your product at the track and have somebody talk to me about your product versus just seeing the car on the thing.
We kind of spoke about this before. First, make your events great, and then the TV will follow. But if your events are floundering to get 20,000 people in the stands, like a lot of IndyCar events have, why would the TV care?
Yeah, exactly.
Make your events great first, then everything else follows.
But checking in with the numbers that we do have anyways, overnight television ratings for the Pocono IndyCar 400 fueled by Sunoco. Oh, I hate Sunoco. That's one brand I will never purchase from just because I'm tired of hearing their name.
I agree.
I just wait until Turbo comes out.
Yeah. And here comes Dale Jr. He takes four tires and a full tank of Sunoco race fuel. Shut your damn mouth. I don't care. Gas. I don't care where it comes from. It could be Shell. It could be Speedway. It could be Circle K. I don't care.
Sinclair!
Just shut the hell up about Sunoco race fuel. Just cram the fuel hose down your throat, pump a gallon in there, and light yourself on fire, because I don't care.
I'm sorry, does Sunoco actually make methanol that you can buy at the gas station?
Well, they don't.
Right.
No, they don't use methanol.
Really uses, yeah.
Ethanol.
Or ethanol, sorry.
And yes.
If you want to smell methanol, go see a sprint car race.
Or what?
It smells awesome.
It does.
But
I guess I remember
like
in the old days.
This smells like apple pie. The IndyCar ratings anyways for the, after my little side tangent, sorry. But yeah, I hate you, Sunoco. So there you go. 1.1 overnight. So that ties, the Texas race and overnight and actually is tied for the highest rated race aside of Indianapolis.
Pretty nice.
Yeah, it's a,
I'll take it.
You know what? I have said it for the longest time. I wouldn't mind the races actually being on ABC or being on a channel where everybody can watch it pretty regularly. I don't mind that. Just get rid of the bumbling buffoons in the top of the booth.
I think that's everybody's biggest complaint with ABC is just dealing with the announcers. And, you know, like I've said, I've watched some of these races and the photography is good. The camera angles are good. It's just these buffoons in the booth that basically make you feel like you're watching the Thursday of a golf tournament.
And this doesn't matter. Tune in on Saturday.
No, but you know what does matter?
There's a pass for the lead.
You know what does matter?
What's that?
The fact that Elio Castroneves leads the point standings.
Yeah.
Indeed.
A great haul for him after the Andretti botchery. It really proved to be a great day for him because the rest of the guys just had a terrible day, honestly. So.
Given the Honda performance, are we seeing Dixon moving up the standings in a very purposeful way? I mean, 291 to Elio's 356, you know.
When Dixon won his championship, he overcame a greater deficit than this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I will say this. I think that Dixon's obviously reasserted himself in the championship picture, but I would say that, what we've got, the only ovals we have left are Fontana, right?
Yeah.
So I would say actually that this is a great opportunity for Scott Dixon, and I'll almost go out on a limb and say that he's taken a page out of Ryan Hunter Ray's book, where Ryan Hunter Ray really came on strong at a few events in the championship about mid-season. And the reason I say this is you look ahead to on the championship, we've got Toronto, definitely a place where Scott Dixon can win. Mid-Ohio, it's
he
almost
owns
a foregone
track.
Yeah,
I was about to say, I will guarantee a Scott Dixon win at Mid-Ohio.
It's almost a foregone conclusion that Scott Dixon's going to win Mid-Ohio. So what we're seeing right now is something that's very similar to what we've seen with Ryan Hunter Ray last year when he came on strong, and that is that Scott Dixon is positioning himself at the right part of the championship to really make a push at Alio. And one of the problems for Castro Neves is the fact that he is kind of inconsistent when it comes to road courses. He is not a guaranteed solid finish every weekend at a road course.
Yeah.
Like he is at Noval. At Noval, you can almost write it in the book that he'll probably be in the top 5, maybe, or at least within the top 10, versus road courses where it can be really hit or miss for him. And I think that Dixon is really positioning himself well if they can get a little more performance out of that Honda to really bring the fight to Castro Neves for the championship. And given Penske's track record at closing the deal on championships, if he's close enough with a couple races to go, I will bet Dixon every day of the week. Just off of what we've seen from Penske and Will Power. But again, the race overall, the product that was Pocono from pretty much all standpoints, I thought was a great event. And I'm really happy to see IndyCar back there. I'm really impressed with people like Spike, who pushed so hard to get the race back to the racetrack, you know, that was originally built for open wheel. And I really did enjoy the event. And it seems like a lot of the people within the surrounding area, because they had healthy, not only did they score reasonable television numbers for their TV, but there was a lot of people there from the local area, and that was another good point.
They definitely said they're very happy with the crowd, and they think they can grow on it next year. I mean, there's a fan base there. There's people that want to see it, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
thought it looked kind of sparse on TV, but you have to realize that Pocono is a large place. And, you know, it didn't look like they closed off any sections of the stands and filled them with banners made with Poconos.
made with China.
Pennsylvania Expo 2014.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, they didn't do any of that funny jazz. And so, you know, when I heard that they were ahead of their projections, that's all I needed to hear. Didn't matter what I saw on the television. If they were happy, I am happy. And also, I want to give a shout out to another extremely hard worker this weekend. Tom and Brenda Turk did an amazing job this weekend, sending us some fantastic imagery and some really creative imagery as well. Our cover photo on the Facebook page is a really, really neat angle of the Indy Lights winner, Carlos Munoz. They're in Victory Lane from high up overhead. Just some fantastic stuff they produce for us. And right now there's a little article that I posted, IndyCar, the Pocono Weekend in Photos, which has a gallery of their images from both the Firestone Indy Lights and the iSide IndyCar Series happenings there. Go check them out. Take a look. And if you're in the D.C. area in that general neck of the woods, be sure to hit them up at piraticalphotography.com and take advantage of their services. They do amazing, amazing work. You could also follow Tom at piratical_Turk on Twitter.
Hey,
so there's my little plug for our outstanding photographers.
Sweet. Hey, does everybody remember how well Mike Conway did at Detroit?
Yes, very well.
So does Dale Coyne.
Yeah, so does Dale Coyne, because he's back in for both Toronto races and both Houston races.
Oh, nice.
So that's something to look forward to this weekend to see if Conway can show the same thing in Toronto, where we will have our very first standing start.
Oh man, I can't wait! I'm so happy.
On Saturday, IndyCar announced the standing start procedures, and it's pretty much going to be like a light tree that you would have at a drag race. Something like 12 lamps on either side of the tree, and they'll basically all light up and then change to green, and suddenly they'll go. That's pretty much, it's the same thing Formula One does, except the light tree's different. False start is going to be penalized, obviously, if a car moves or is in front of their line at the time of race start. Aborted start can be declared before the final row of red lights is illuminated on the lighting panel. If the start is aborted, the full course caution lights will be turned on. In the event of an aborted start, a rolling start shall be implemented. Gentlemen,
this is what I think will happen.
I'm going to say that's probably my best guess, because they haven't had a chance to practice this. They've never done it in the IndyCar series, and we still have the deal to deal with the anti-stall system. I mean, basically we're waiting. They didn't do standing starts last year because they wanted to get the anti-stall system worked out, and so far we haven't really seen much indication that it has been worked out. So,
yep. Well, I can't wait for it. I hope it works out well, because I remember there was a lot of griping and bitching at the start of when it was announced. They were like, "Oh, standing starts? No, that's so Formula One."
Well,
and so I hope it works.
Get used to it. Get used to it, because I'm guessing that we'll see standing starts at all the street courses next year.
Nice.
That would be my thought, but we'll see. We'll see if this new leadership has other ideas. It's going to be a knife fight in Detroit. You got, or not Detroit, but Toronto. It's
That'll
already
probably be a knife fight in Detroit.
Yeah. In fact, there's one going on now. You've got one of the most contested street course races. You know, the most hotly fought over street course races. And everybody usually leaves there with a bone to pick with somebody. Well, now you don't have a week to work out that bone. You've got 24 hours and, 22 hours, you know, till the next race starts. So it could be very interesting. We could have some very interesting storylines going into day two in Toronto when they do the rolling start.
Mm.
And over the weekend, I guess the track was under like waist high water. So they're saying that everything's fine now. Everything's fine here. How are you?
Well, as I understand, the officials in Toronto were trying to create a more flowing circuit.
Nice.
So they decided to introduce water.
I really liked what Eric Schwarzkopf of Trackside Online, their photographer, said on Facebook, that Toronto had added unlimited hydroplanes to the IndyCar weekend schedule.
Is this what Bernie was joking about when saying that they should add irrigation to tracks?
Just add water.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's the new engineering challenge in Formula One. If you can turn your car into a hydrofoil by pressing a button.
Hey, all of a sudden,
Lotus says, "Hey, we have experience at this."
Nice.
No, they have experience in making boat anchors.
Well, no, I was thinking of the, what was it, For Your Eyes Only?
Yes, indeed. You're right. That was a Lotus. That was a Lotus.
Thank you.
The Bond car.
Ah, yes.
The Bond car that, yeah.
It was a Lotus, what is it, the Elise?
Esprit.
Oh, no. Yeah, Esprit, that's the right one, I'm sorry, wrong one.
An E-Spirit.
Yeah, E-Spirit. Well, what was it? We'll see how the track is come race weekend, this weekend. I mean, it's pretty tough when you've got waist-high water and we're, 4 days away from the event?
Yeah, the track basically has issued statements saying everything's ready to go. We've designed it with this, you know, eventuality so that, you know, water could seep through and this, that, and the other. So they're saying that they're all ready to go already. So that's good.
Yeah.
So in the interest of moving quickly, Doug.
Yes, 15 seconds. Mazda to Indy, go.
Munoz wins, flag to flag, takes over the points lead once again.
Was there much of a doubt?
Well, actually, I thought, yes, this is the perfect type of track for Sage Karam. So I really thought it would be more of a knife fight between Munoz and Karam, to be honest. And Karam was up there. He just, you know, no one had anything for Munoz. They just didn't. And he just ran away from everybody else. However, Karam and Chavez had a nice little battle between themselves for second and third. They fought well. It was really some fun stuff to watch. Zach Beach had a nice finish in P4. You're only eight drivers, right? So a nice finish, P4. Hey, you finished mid pack. but no, he drove very well, very quick. Just wasn't quite quick enough to keep up with Karam and Chavez. The Bilardi guys really had a tough time of it. Hawksworth again fell off the pace on an oval. I thought after Iowa that maybe he had a bit of confidence and some additional knowledge to kind of boost him along, but he was fifth and struggling. Juan Pablo Garcia, whom we talked to last week as part of our Inside the Helmet series, he ended up in P6, doing reasonably well. And Dempsey and Goncalves, the entire Bilardi team just never got a hold of the Tricky Triangle. They just could not figure out this track. They tested okay, but when it came time for practice quals, no, they were way off pace and continued into race day. Dempsey finished in seventh and Goncalves in eighth. That put Dempsey back even further adrift from Chavez. It looked like he had the opportunity after Indianapolis to overtake Chavez in the points title and take over P3. But now he's falling dangerously close to Hawksworth, who has opportunity now. Well, they're only separated by 5 points. Dempsey with 226 and Hawksworth with 221. So Toronto is going to be interesting to see what happens. Between Munoz and Karam, this is where the real battle is, between these two for the championship title. Munoz has 285, and Sage Karam has 281. So, again, 4 points separating him. It is tight, tight, tight. Whoever wins Toronto comes out with the points lead. And last year, this was the first venue where Sage Karam won on a twisty track in Pro Mazda or Star Mazda then. So Toronto is the type of track that Karam really, really likes. He podiumed at St. Pete and at Long Beach, both street courses. This is the type of circuit that he really enjoys. And you know, Munoz has won DNF on a street course. So although he's quick, it's not unforeseeable that he could end up in a wall for one reason or another and end up losing out. But I don't know that we're actually going to see a race up front at Toronto. I think what we're going to see instead is who drives with fewer mistakes, if that makes sense to y'all. But anyway, yeah. it still should be very, very entertaining. I'm excited about the Toronto weekend.
I did notice that Matthew DeLeo is going to be back.
Yes, he ran at
Long Beach.
Yeah, he ran at Long Beach. He's been in USF 2000 for quite a while. But now he's coming back here again at the street course. He's kind of avoided the ovals, which is a smart move, financially, if nothing else. But anyway, will he be competitive? No, he won't be. But it'll be another good learning opportunity and another opportunity to put him on the path to competing in 2014. So I really like how DeLeo has arranged his program and how he's approaching this. I think it's very smart.
Yeah, I saw where he's ready to do a full season in 2014.
And that's why I say he's doing this wisely and getting things put together, you know, understanding the equipment, understanding the nature of the racing this season in preparation for a full run in 2014. So, but the Firestone Indy Lights series is the only series that's actually running in running one race this weekend. Of course, the Eyesight IndyCar series is running two races, but so are the Pro Mazda Championship and the USF 2000 National Championship. Pro Mazda continues to struggle for entrants. We have 10, which is one more than what Indy Lights has. And it's our same usual people, so no real surprise. Nicholas Costa joins Team Pelfrey instead of Anders Krohn. So we're still missing Petri Svanto, but we have that one swap in the number 82 car, but that's it. Who this goes to, man, that's a good question. Because really, when you look at where the point standings are right now for Pro Mazda, it's Matthew Brabham who's easily in the lead. However, from there on back, it gets a little dicey. Who else is going to end up on the podium? Diego Ferreira had been strong early on. He struggled on the ovals. But back on a street circuit, I think this plays well into his hands. Shelby Blackstock, who we saw this weekend, can really hustle a car around a twisty circuit. He ran in the Continental Tire Series this past weekend on one of the Roush Mustangs and ran very well in the lead for, I forget for how many laps, but for a good portion. There was one amazing move. And Kevin, I know you saw this race. You can help me out with this. There was one move that he made on a restart where he came from fourth and exited turn one in the lead by like two or three car lengths. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That was it was phenomenal display of driving. So I wouldn't count out Blackstock either for a podium position. But, man, I really don't know if anybody has anything for Brabham. He is just class of the field.
You know, I think Shelby is definitely at probably the pinnacle of his open wheel abilities. But let me tell you, I think he's really got a career ahead of him in sports cars if he decides to go that path.
I was impressed at how he manhandled that Roush Mustang. That was really great stuff.
I'm telling you, that Continental Tire Series racing is some of the best there is on TV.
You know, Sean and I have been talking about that for a couple of years now. That you know, I've never really been impressed with the GT. It's okay, but the Continental Tire Series, I've always loved watching. Watching that series, and I'm excited about them coming to Kansas City.
Yes, that they will be coming to Kansas City. I look forward to that. I can't wait till they're out here.
Yeah, should be good. Good stuff.
They're gonna come race the oval. I mean, oh wait, the road course with two turns.
The paperclip.
Yes.
I mean, that's really what that infield road course looks like. It looks like a paperclip.
Yep. If you ever get a chance to go to a Continental Tire Series race. Man, when they do their autograph sessions, like on Saturdays or something, you talk about a party, man. That's one of the things I love about the race weekends at Barber, where they have the IndyCar and then Rolex Series and Continental Tire Series all together right there, is on Saturdays of the Grand Am races, they traditionally do a fam walk and autograph session in the pits for all the Grand Am drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Grand Am does their autograph sessions is the teams all just set up a little folding table with chairs behind their haulers, and you just walk from hauler to hauler and get whoever's autographs you want, like IndyCar, where you have the big lines.
Right.
You go up to the Continental Tire Series paddock, and there's music blaring everywhere, and teams are giving away donuts and drinks and stuff.
Nice.
It's a blast.
Well, you know, I will say that they can get away with that because generally they have less people to try and corral and manage.
Oh yeah.
You know, so there is that advantage. You know, because the Pirelli World Challenge autograph sessions are the same way. Very low key. You walk up, you chit chat, and it's great fun. But Anyway, so not to get sidetracked too much, talking about sports car, although we will talk about it again. Of course, the Kansas Speedway, for Sean and I, that's our home track.
Woo-hoo!
And so we'll be talking about that more as the time comes. But Pro Mazda running two events with 10 drivers this weekend. But really, what you should be watching this year at pardon me. And in fact, for both the Pro Mazda and the USF 2000, you can tap into their live timing and scoring and listen to Rob Howden call the race live while you chat with the series officials and a few of us Mazda Road to Indy geeks. And it is brilliant stuff. Howden is an amazing, amazing broadcaster. He calls a fantastic race, very energetic, and it's tons of fun being there in the group and chatting. But the USF 2000 series, they are bringing 30 cars to the grid. So Indy Lights is bringing 9, Pro Mazda is bringing 10, USF 2000 is bringing 30. And this should be an epic race. Neil Albarico has been lightning quick, so long as he can keep it on the island, right? But he's had trouble with that, and because of that, he has languished way back in 8th spot in the championship. Hargrove leads championship right now easily with 141 points over Wyatt Gooden, who only has 88 points. So extremely comfortable lead in the championship. 3 wins out of the 5 events run so far. So, you know, I really think Hargrove, especially since they're coming to Toronto, this for him is, this is his home Grand Prix, right? This is his home race weekend, along with Garrett Grist, Jesse Lazare, Stefan Rosinski, and Dalton Kellett, and Daniel Burkett, all Canadians. And, you know, so look for them to really be trying their best to show as strong as they can. But I think Garrett Grist and Hargrove are going to be the two that will be pushing the hardest, or at least be the two that are closest to the sharp end of the grid. Danilo Estrella, after coming off of his first oval experience and ran well, of course, back at the Night Before 500 at Lucas Oil Raceway, finishing fourth. He had mentioned that he did not like ovals and was looking forward to getting back to the twisty tracks. Well, now it's put up or shut up time, right? Because here we are back at the twisties, and he had a DNF. Well, not a DNF. He had a poor showing at St. Pete in race 1, came back to finish P4 in race 2, and at Sebring he had 2 P3s. But if he's going to overtake Gooden, he's really got to step it up and start going for that race win. You know, I don't know if there's enough time left to catch Hargrove. They're doing a three-peat at Mid-Ohio, but still, it's going to be tough. I think his best bet is just going to be coming in P2. So anyway, that's your Mazda Road to Indy wrap up for this week.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Well, that moves us right into F1, and this is going to be an interesting segment because we're going to talk briefly about the results at Silverstone. This is the only thing we're going to talk about the results. Nico Rosberg won.
Yeah.
Hooray!
Woo! However, everything else that happened at Silverstone is probably of more potential for discussion, because Lewis Hamilton's car had a left rear failure on lap 7, falling out of the lead at his home Grand Prix. That wasn't the only left rear failure. Felipe Massa, Jean-Éric Vergne, and Sergio Perez had left rear failures during the race. Perez also had one during practice. Esteban Gutierrez had a left front failure during the race. Nico Rosberg had signs of tire failure happening, and they pitted him just in time. Same with Fernando Alonso
and
Vettel. Vettel, his race was run when he had a box full of neutrals developed. Yes. Much to the cheers of the British fans, which actually got a bit of play in the media. That all said, the tire situation was ridiculous. Pirelli came to the race and had a new construction or a new way of adhesing the tire together, a new process, but it was the same construction, same everything, because the teams voted. Well, the teams didn't vote. They just said, no, we won't allow you to change a compound mid-season. Pirelli didn't say it was a safety issue, so therefore it couldn't be by the FIA forced through as a safety issue. And this is what we got. So, yeah. Comments, gentlemen. Thoughts on the tire debacle as it was over that weekend?
Well, if I go real quick, I'll just say that that there's two sides to every story, naturally. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that strict guidance was passed, you know, because this year the tires are not interchangeable. A left rear tire is a left rear tire. It's not a mm-hmm. rear tire. So you have to make sure you do that right. Two, there are prescribed PSI ratings or air pressure ratings for the tires mm-hmm. that you have to adhere to keep them from having these kinds of catastrophic failures. They're handed out to everybody. And that, especially that, the PSI thing, is a big issue because it is not the first time that we've had teams running a camber or pushing the limits of the camber that caused rubber to wear away on the inside shoulders of the tires like that. If you remember back a couple, I think it was last season, Vettel and the Red Bull guys ran a race where they had like an extreme camber rating and they thought the tires were going to fail then. And it was not down to the construction of the tire. It was down to the fact that the teams just do whatever the hell they want to get the performance out of the tires that they need to run their race and perform well. And I think personally that Silverstone was an example of where people were trying to get the most out of the tires and that they pushed it too far. And unfortunately, Pirelli was the fall guy in that. And that.
Well, in the pre-race for Nürburgring, it was explained about the asymmetrical tires that the reason they come apart like that is the fact that the way the leading edge on the tire is developed. The belt is put on the tire to rotate in a certain way, mm-hmm. and when you put it on backwards, the belt on the tire has a tendency to lift and come apart if you run it the wrong way. Now, they said that one thing, though, is that next year Pirelli tires will be symmetrical instead of asymmetrical, so you'll just have fronts and rears instead of, like, left rear, right rear.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that needs to be done, but at the same point in time, we cannot, you know, I just thought it was one of the things that really, I don't want to say it upset me, because F1 doesn't really upset me. If something goes wrong, it's usually just kind of like, that figures, but the fact of the matter is that everybody, teams, fans, and everybody were quick to jump on Pirelli's back saying, well, you can't even make a tire that can hold the load of the car.
Wasn't Pirelli's fault.
Yeah, exactly. No, we did make a tire that can hold the load, but you chose to do things, you know, not the way that the guidance, you know, was suggested to you, and that's why you have the situation you have. It's just the same thing that you have, like, in anything. Like, even in the military, for example, there is a procedure. It is wrote in stone. You will follow that procedure to a T, or you'll be fired and put in jail. That's all there is to it. You will follow the rules. And the teams didn't do that and wanted to bitch at Pirelli about it when it was not a Pirelli issue, and I said that from the get-go.
So. Yeah, and what we found out in the aftermath of Silverstone was basically that, you know, they went to a much squarer shoulder tire this year where they used to have a balloon tire. The teams want to increase that contact patch by running a lower PSI in the tires that increases the contact patch, but then it relies more on that square shoulder to give the tire structure, and it just tore the square shoulder apart.
Yeah.
Or serves to do that. It really came to light at Silverstone because you've got a lot of high speed, high deg corners. But specifically the sharper rumble strip on turn four, seemed to be causing the majority of the issues, in concert with everything else that was going on. Pirelli came out after the Grand Prix and basically said, here's the situation. Yeah, we'll take some of the blame on ourselves for this because we have not been forceful in our statement of the following things. Number one, the tire pressures that we found almost on every car that had failure, the tire pressures were too low. Mm-hmm. The other thing we found on almost every car that had a failure was they're swapping the left rear and the right rear because gives you, it potentially gives you better grip because of the way the tires are, constructed, whatever. But it causes more degradation on the tire and destroys the tire. The other thing they said was the camber ratings, like you said, were out of skew and they weren't within Pirelli's recommendations. All three of those were outside of Pirelli's recommendations, and their request to the FIA was to make Pirelli's recommendations mandated and scrutineered portions of the technical regulations.
Yes, and that is crucial because when you look at the way that the FIA does things, the FIA demands a product from Pirelli to make a good show, put on a good spectacle. Pirelli is not allowed to test that product, basically, that show-changing piece. They're not allowed to test it in the season. And they were given a lousy 2010 car to try and test these tires. I'm sorry, a 2010 car is not going to give you enough useful data that the now 2013 cars are putting together. And the 2013 cars are much more advanced, even though, they're supposed to be frozen or whatever. You're not going to get the kind of data from a 2010 car that you need from a 2013 car. And that I thought was funny when we seen the FIA move to the direction of saying, oh, well, the young driver test that we had scheduled. Yeah, we'll go ahead and make that you can run your top drivers, basically making it a mid-season test. Thus, doing the thing where we needed to have mid-season testing. So we can really bring it full circle and say that everybody had a piece of the pie. Pirelli for the construction, the teams because they don't know how to do the proper mounting and installation of the product and refuse to follow the regulations set forth by Pirelli. And then the FIA, because they say that that we're not going to get mid-season testing because it costs too much. But then we have situations like this where tires are failing, people are pissed, and it's the FIA's fault for not opening up mid-season testing, which people have been bitching about for years since they stopped doing it. So this is just as much their damn fault as anyone else. And I told people that when I took to the Twitter after Silverstone, I said, you know what? This is a problem with the FIA, the problem that they got rid of mid-season testing, and the fact that this is the kind of stuff that we've all been talking about, and it takes an event like this to actually put that into practice, as we've seen the FIA do.
Yeah.
Vindicated. Done. I'm out
Vindicated,
of here.
And here's the other statement from Silverstone. It's my opinion that they should have thrown the red flag.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. Get rid of all
you're
the debris.
You're talking about driver safety, and in the build-up to the Nürburgring race, the Grand Prix Drivers Association got together and said, if we see anything similar to what we saw at Silverstone in the lead-up to the race, we will boycott the race, and good on them.
Yep.
Definitely.
Any of the commentators that came out, I heard the BBC guys saying things against the drivers for, oh, this seems to be an overreaction. No! You're talking about the lives of the drivers, the fans, and the track marshals.
The drivers don't choose the tires that are going on. That's the engineers. The drivers are in there to drive fast, right?
Yeah.
So, they're doing their job, and if they can't do it safely, boycott.
Absolutely. So anybody who wanted to say anything against that, that's ridiculous.
What I found interesting and impressive was how suddenly after all of this, the amount of agreement across all parties.
Yeah. All of a sudden, everybody's like, friends.
We should agree and make changes together.
That's your tire pressure? Oh, okay. We'll put it right in the car right now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I remember during Silverstone, they showed a picture of Christian Horner looking at a picture of the tire degradation on his car. And Pirelli's handwritten recommendations across the top were up the PSI by 2.
Yeah.
And Hobbs got on there and he said 2 PSI is massive. He said when they come in and they change tire pressures on a car, they change them in like less than a quarter of PSI.
Oh, wow.
So he's like, that's massive. That's a big deal. Well, it was Pirelli saying, idiots, you should have done this in the first place. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the young driver test thing is interesting because the young driver test is no longer a young driver test. So everybody who's been complaining about the fact that there is no testing in F1, therefore you don't have a chance to get young drivers seat time. Well, they don't get any this year.
Well, hey, guess what?
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you don't get a young driver test. How about we just make a product that's safe and where we don't have tire carcasses flying at people's faces?
See,
because you're going to be going through a lot of drivers if they're getting hit in the face with tire carcasses.
It just goes on to what you said, Sean. This is something that should have been in F1 no matter what. They've been complaining about it for quite a while. Most of the teams are not happy with the fact there's no testing unless you're Marussia. But now, because of this overreaction that we have to do something about these tires, well, I shouldn't say overreaction, but this reaction that we have to do something about the tires, the only chance young drivers had to test in F1 is gone for this season. And Mercedes, who is no longer part of the young driver test due to their punishment for testing Pirelli tires incorrectly, their punishment turns out to be even more severe because now they're not able to do this new tire test with these new compounds that they're bringing in to finish out the season.
Yep.
That's a big deal, and it's interesting. You know, in my opinion, it's at the FIA who didn't. I'll just say this bluntly: the FIA didn't like the results of the tribunal because the tribunal didn't punish Mercedes harshly. And the tribunal found that the FIA needed to be complicit and had to pay one third of the court costs. So now Mercedes is saying, you know, this is pretty crazy because we're not going to get to test these tires now, and we'd really like to. And Lewis Hamilton's out there making a big stink about it. And the FIA is going to sit there and say, screw you.
Yeah, I thought the things that Hamilton was saying after the race were just ridiculous. I was like, Lewis, come on. It's not Pirelli's fault that you burn the tires off. It's not Pirelli's fault the Mercedes sucks at tire degradation in the heat. Just so stop using him as the fall guy. Take responsibility and realize that this is the challenge that you, Lewis Hamilton, left McLaren Mercedes for to be in a competitive Mercedes team, which has done very well for themselves this year compared to other years, but they still have the same problems. So stop bitching about it. You knew this coming in. You knew it. So shut up, please. I liked it better when he didn't talk. But anyways, yo. Doug,
Twitter, tough guy.
Yeah, right.
Yo, I would like.
What are we gonna... Go ahead.
I would like to see Pirelli just look the entire FIA, FOM, the drivers, the teams, and say, we're getting nothing out of this. We're getting less than nothing out of this. Screw you guys. We're going home. Enjoy trying to find some tires on Tire Rack.
Yeah, well, that's what I would have said. If I was the guy, if I was Mr. Embry, I would have said, you know what? I would have said expletive deleted you, and I would have said figured
no,
out yourself.
No, you wouldn't have expletive deleted it.
No, it would not have been expletive deleted. You know me, Doug. It would not have been expletive deleted.
Nice. It would be dropped. Sebastian Vettel on the podium in Istanbul, right?
Yes, Sebastian Vettel on the podium of Abu Dhabi.
Abu Dhabi, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would have told him. And I would say, do you want to know? I'd tell him. I'd be like, you know what? You want this freaking lavish product. You want this huge product where you can do whatever you want to do and have this show with your stupid DRS, your stupid KERS system, and now you want to spruce up the show with a tire and you won't even let me test my product before I put it on a car, and then how dare you turn around and bitch at me because you're having failures when you are blatantly disrespecting the numbers that our engineers put together to get this done. So that's what I would say. I would say, so screw you. If you don't like it, get another manufacturer. But if they see the way you're treating us, I bet it's going to be pretty difficult for you to find another manufacturer.
Yeah.
And I'd walk out of the tribunal.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I would do.
Okay, gentlemen,
anyway,
segue to Nürburgring.
Yes.
Weber, following Silverstone, drops the bombshell, I'm going to Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
It had been rumored, and now he's retired, and the driver market in F1 is wide open. Those who have been rumored to be going there, I've heard Paul DiResta, which probably is not going to happen. I've heard Jenson Button.
Yeah, he's on the short list. The odds in England actually fluctuated heavily overnight, basically, because originally, as you were going to say, as I'm sure you're about to say, Kimi Raikkonen is on the list and is the odds on favorite to team up with his good buddy Sebastian Vettel. But yeah, it was really crazy because the odds really shifted in the middle of the night for Jenson Button to join the team, and I think that would be fantastic.
That'd be pretty cool to see.
Him or Raikkonen. I mean, Raikkonen there would be awesome and fits Raikkonen's personality, but having Button there would make that team just legit. I mean, they'd be unstoppable in the manufacturer.
Jenson may be the most underrated driver in Formula One.
I don't even think he's underrated. I think he got screwed over that the fact that McLaren decided to just redesign the whole entire car a year before. Now, we'll see if this is something that they're playing to the 2014 regulations or not. I don't know, but this was a bad idea to redesign the car entirely if they were looking for wins. I have to think that there's something behind this that is prepping them going forward, yeah, because you cannot do this, and this is not acceptable for a team like McLaren.
Yeah, the other thing that I want to throw in here in the segue to Nürburgring, if you are owed money by Peter Sauber, line up, because you're not the only ones. There are reports that team members and drivers are not getting paid, and drivers are being told to, you know, put out their resumes now because they're not going to be back. And it's looking bad. They're looking for investors. They're looking for buyers. And Sauber at this point may not make it through the season and may end up in litigation due to money they owe everybody. So things are looking bad there. And we've said strange things about Force India as well. So yep, Sauber is kind of added to the list of hurtful things in F1. But let's go to Nürburgring, where tires were not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Qualifying session.
I could actually say one more thing about the driver market and that Sauber announcement you just made. That is that is another thing that throws it wide open, because I know that for a fact that Nico Hülkenberg is a very hot, sought-after commodity within the paddock. So that could also change things as well.
I've heard him mentioned as high as replacing Massa.
Yeah, exactly. He's a huge favorite to move up to the top tier teams. And with that, I will let you segue. But I think that it's important to note that along with Weber retiring, we have perhaps Sauber going under, Hülkenberg being told that he could be a free agent, which also further puts the F1 drivers market on its head, as we now seemingly will have probably four top seats available, because you'll have Weber's seat, probably Massa's seat, and then you'll have, or maybe even Button's seat, or even Raikkonen. So we've got a lot of guys that could potentially move, and it could be a very good off season for Formula One.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got qualifying results for the German Grand Prix. We'll breeze through these because let's move to the end of the show. Lewis Hamilton qualified on pole. It didn't do him much good because he got swamped at turn one by Vettel and Weber. Weber having a good start. Vettel and Weber qualified second and third, Raikkonen fourth, Grosjean fifth. Kind of interesting results for Lotus for the race. I mean, good qualifications, good racing. Daniel Ricciardo and the Toro Rosso in sixth, question mark. Very nice. Felipe Massa and Fernando Alonso qualified seventh and eighth, and Button and Hülkenberg took no time in practice or in Q3. That said, Alonso and Massa came out and did a couple of laps on hard tires as a strategy so they could start on hard tires and run as far as they could into the first stint. That didn't work out very well for Fernando Alonso on race day, though, because Alonso ended up, he must have had kind of bad wear issues with tires or something like that, because he ended up pitting just three or four laps after the soft tires pitted.
He pitted like on lap 12, I think, and they're supposed to last like 20.
Yeah, that's what they're hoping. So something was
meanwhile,
going on
everybody
there.
Else was pitting on lap 6 with the soft tires. So their strategy was totally messed up.
Felipe Massa didn't have a chance to get to his first pit stop because he all by himself. All by myself.
Oh, don't.
Nice. I like it.
Stop.
You have to find out what I was trying to figure out what the hell actually happened there.
There were no good camera shots of it, but everything we could see is he just spun by himself and that was it. Stalled the car out of the race, and he from the start, man, he fired out the start like a gun and was looking good, but I don't know. He was running fifth when he spun, so bad deal for Ferrari, and it continues to add to the fire that Massa is not back, but we'll see. Also of note, during the race, we had a blown engine from a Marussia. He was crop dusting, I think, in Germany.
Oh,
I think that's
man,
what
that
it was.
Was white, the white fire.
Ironically enough, it was a Frenchman cross in Germany.
That was a beautiful explosion if I've ever seen one.
Hobbs is like, oh, we got a kablamo. I was like, oh my god, it's been years. I don't think I've heard that since the Honda days.
he forgot to set the e-brake when he got out of the car.
Ooh, yeah, that's a
right.
Is that an issue though for him, because he's supposed to flip the wheel to put the car in neutral?
Okay, I heard an explanation.
Okay,
I heard an explanation. Yeah. The driver's obligation is to put the steering wheel back on the car so the track marshals can move it. The driver is to leave the car in neutral so they can maneuver the car.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also heard though that there is an override to neutral that apparently the course people can do.
Yeah,
I don't know how they can gauge that. So whether or not the car is in neutral or left in neutral or not by the driver, they can gauge neutral.
That said, if you didn't see the Grand Prix, what happened was the driver furiously got out of the car because it was burning. the onboard fire extinguishers put it out fairly efficiently. However, when he got out of the car, he put the wheel on, walking away from the car. And the next thing you know, we get a cut back to the car rolling across the track.
Marussia has gone all year.
I seen a great meme on the Facebook. It says, pilotless Marussia rolling backwards, still faster than Max Chilton.
Wow.
Ouch.
Nice. It was classic. I was like, well played. Yes, I was like, well played, sir. I'll allow it.
Yeah, that set up a nice safety car period, during which Mark Webber came in for a pit stop.
Yeah, bad news.
Bad news. Webber came in for a pit stop. They swapped out the tire and had trouble getting the nut on the right rear corner of the car.
And yet the rear guy drops the jack.
Yeah. They drop the jack. They send the car.
Okay, I'll let him go.
Yeah. Drop the jack, send the car, and the wheel comes off almost immediately. Starts spinning down pit lane 60, 70 miles an hour because that car has phenomenal torque, just like all of them do.
Yeah.
I heard an explanation of it. Some of the team guys jumped out of the way. One of the cameramen who saw it jumped out of the way, leaving his camera in place. The wheel hit the camera that was in place, bounced up in the air, and landed, you know, squarely on another cameraman who was turned away, thankfully, at the time. It hit him in the side. He had broken ribs and a broken collarbone from the impact. And last I heard, he's still in the hospital.
You know, I'm going to stop you right there. And I do not think at all that it's thankful that he was looking away.
Yeah.
Rule number one of motorsports photography is to look up track.
I think he turned to the side. I'm saying if he had been looking up track and got hit face on with that thing, it could have been far worse damage.
Well, if he had been looking up track, he would have gotten the hell out the way. Yeah. Is what I'm
saying.
Yeah.
How many other people that
were closer to that got hit?
Well, it was. I mean, he was right there. I mean, that firmly hit.
There was a lot of other people that were right there that were looking up track
a dozen people that got out of the way, and then it clobbered that guy. Although during the coverage, they said he did actually get up and walk away on his own power. But yeah, he probably had broken ribs and maybe collarbone. Nothing with that was a compound fracture, I don't think. Obviously painful as all hell.
One piece of advice I was given at the Barber Open test this year from a veteran motorsports rider, much more experienced than I was, no matter what you're doing, when you are in the vicinity of the pit wall, always walk and look towards the traffic.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Rule number one.
But, gentlemen, I'm going to go the other way on this. This guy was hired for a different reason. This is an FOM cameraman who is taking pictures of active pit stops. I'm not saying that he shouldn't have been looking. He should have been. However, what should have been is what every other racing series has. You don't have cameramen over the wall.
Yeah.
Or, if you do, he wears safety equipment instead of freaking street clothes.
Well, I was talking to somebody else about this, and you know, our view on it is if he was going to be over the wall and his job was to image, you know, take video of cars exiting the pits, then he needs to have a spotter. Mm-hmm. He needs to have someone attached to his hip that is looking up track and is ready to jerk him violently out of the way if something nasty starts coming his way.
Well, the FI... I remember seeing it, and I was just like, oh, my God, that dude just got tattooed.
The FIA's response is that they are not going to allow cameramen over the wall. The only people over the wall are officials and crew, and they'll be properly attired in safety equipment. So,
Good play.
I totally agree. It shouldn't have been allowed in the first place. So, unfortunately, this is where we stand. Somebody has to get hurt before they realize, oh, this is a safety problem.
Well, safety rules are often written in blood.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate thing. And, never mind. Red Bull was fined over the incident €30,000. I will say fined quite lightly compared to past ones. I remember after the Felipe Massa and what was the gentleman?
Was it Weber?
I'm sorry.
No, earlier this year.
No, it was after the gentleman who died, Henry Surtees, is that correct?
Yeah.
And then the Massa incident right back to back. A Renault was leaving pit lane and had a tire spin off, and it was actually out on the track when the tire came off, and they got fined like $100,000 and lots of points to make a statement.
Did you see the look on that that Red Bull wrench as that car was pulling out of the pit, though?
He's like,
oh, he was
what
angry.
Are you guys doing?
Yeah. He's like, why did you do that? What are you thinking? You had enough time. Yeah, he's like, bro, if you would have been doing your job, he's like, I was trying to put the tire on.
Yeah.
And then it just hit the guy in the face. And that, as soon as, if that guy's seen that, he's probably thinking, oh, damn. Yeah. Not good.
Adon's killed me if a tog.
Yeah, he's like, I've just killed a Doug Patterson.
Yeah. This set up an interesting end to the race because Alonso, who was off strategy up to this point, now was on the same strategy as everybody else, and it set up a run for the finish. Vettel was well ahead of everybody, but that took his gap down. At one point, Kimi Raikkonen was like 15 seconds clear of the field, but he had to come in for a pit. And he was actually kind of a little upset with his team that they called him into pit, and he was willing to just try and work it out and take those hard tires as long as possible.
But he also had to pit no matter what because he hadn't run the soft tires yet.
Did he?
Did he start on the softs?
I thought he started on the softs.
Oh, you know, maybe he did, because I thought they were saying that he had to pit, but maybe somebody else they were talking about.
I may be wrong on that, but anyway, going into the closing stages of the race, Vettel was leading Roman Grosjean and Raikkonen following, and Alonso following that. Raikkonen was getting a little pressure from Fernando, but he was also pressuring Grosjean, was able to get around Grosjean and set sail to try and close the 4.5-5 second gap that Vettel had already pulled on the field. Was able to do that by the end of the race, so that was nice stuff. But
that last 10 laps of the race was phenomenal to watch.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he was able to close the gap, but he wasn't able to make anything close to a pass. Kind of the same thing was going on with Alonso. He was able to close the gap to Roman Grosjean, but he really didn't have anything for him in the closing stages. There's not much of a DRS zone at Nürburgring. Mm-hmm. It's a very short section of the track. So unfortunately, that was not to be to see a pass at the end. But then again, you know, that's exactly what we want to see. We want to see good racing. It doesn't necessarily mean we want to see passes. We just want to see good racing, and that's what we got. So good results at Nürburgring. The only people who would say it wasn't a good result, let's go through the podium. You had Vettel on the top step, followed by Raikkonen, followed by Roman Grosjean, Alonso in fourth. That said, those who would say it wasn't a good result would be those who were driving Mercedes vehicles because their tire issues reared their head again.
Not again.
Going on from that, Lewis Hamilton did end up finishing fifth, and that's a good result for as much degradation.
It really was,
as
yeah.
Any
yeah.
issues as they were having. Jenson Button finished sixth, two spots ahead of Sergio Perez. Mark Webber, good on him for being able to get that car back in
Webber
a seventh after
the did
issues.
An amazing yeah. drive. He really did. I mean, he was at the very back of the pack after that tire incident. He had to wheel him back to the pit stall there, and man, that was an impressive drive, actually, watching him pass all the way up through the field.
Yeah, Nico Rosberg in ninth, Hülkenberg in 10th. Other notables, I don't care. you like that?
Nice.
Moving on. Sebastian Vettel, 157 points in the championship. Alonso is his next closest, 123 points. There are some distance placed by this race because Vettel definitely finished higher than Alonso. Raikkonen made a little bit of ground on Alonso, but by finishing second to Vettel, he didn't make points on Vettel. So Raikkonen's at 118. Hamilton's at 97.
Webber's
at 93. Rosberg's at 84. Red Bull is at 250 points in the Constructors' Championship. Mercedes jumped Ferrari this weekend to 181. Ferrari's 180. So very, very interesting results. Yeah. It's moving forward. So
good battle there. What a coup that'd be for Mercedes if they could somehow hold on to that. I mean, I don't think it's likely, but it might be. I mean, they've got two drivers that are performing pretty well.
They do, and they're definitely a stronger pairing right now than Alonso and Massa. Specifically, the Ferrari is not qualifying well at all, and it doesn't seem to have anything close to race pace. It's getting by on strategy and, you know, bootstrapping by Alonso as normal. So, Ross Braun came out after the race. And he basically said the ban on tire swapping this weekend, swapping the right rear and the left rear to put them on opposite corners, that was a problem. And, well, that's what they found out, I guess, in their testing, that if they swap those tires, everything works better.
So basically they're doing their setup for the wrong configuration. That's great.
Yeah. That's pretty much it. That's what they discovered. So that's too bad.
Oh, we can't swap tires, and that takes away another chance for us to bitch about the tires failing.
But like Pirelli said, almost every incident of tire failure that they saw at Silverstone was because the tires were on the opposite corner. So everybody was doing it.
Oh yeah, I'm not pinpointing that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that they're like the only baddies.
Yeah. Next up, Hungary in 3 weeks, and we're done with F1.
Yeah, oh boy, Hungary. Can't wait for that.
And now for the fastest 9 minutes in rally.
Yes. Yeah. Well, actually, we didn't really have a rally this last week, so.
Sweet. Let's go through it quick then.
Yeah, no rallies to cover, but we did have some pretty good news. And it was something that you and I actually talked about, Mike, mm-hmm. with Colin Clark, and that was Sebastian Loeb's come out and said, you know, I'm really
wait. Brilliant interview with Colin Clark. Anytime you can talk to that man, do it.
You enjoyed that, did you?
Yes, I did.
Oh, nice.
Excellent.
Well, yeah, I'm glad that you liked it, and I hope everybody that's listening also enjoyed it. So it was always a pleasure to talk to him, and always one of my, you know, I hate to say it, but he's probably my favorite person to interview because he just makes it that easy. That easy for me. But yeah, one of the things that we talked about, Mike, was the Mike Shaw, that is intern, is that Sebastian Loeb has told Citroën, no, I simply will not compete in any more rallies with you outside of our scheduled four because I can't, you know, I'm busy. I have a WTCC championship to prepare for. I have also my own team running in the FIA GT championship right now with McLaren. I have a lot of stuff going on and I can't help you. You pick terrible drivers, basically is what I'm thinking he was kind of in the back of his mind. You pick terrible drivers. This is what happens. This is not my fault.
The bat phone has gone dark.
Yes, exactly. He's like, screw this. The Joker's your problem. Click.
Nice. Citroën spends every dark night, you know, every moonless light with the night with the Loeb light shining into the sky, but he just doesn't show up.
Falls on deaf ears, bro. Falls on deaf ears. But yeah, well, I think it's like Colin said, you know, he's a busy man. He's got a lot of things going on, and certainly, you know, helping Citroen out, you know, this is Citroen's thing. This is Citroen's problem. They need to find a way to get through it and really do, you know, their own kind of thing. You know, I have too much on the plate.
Well, Loeb should call sense, a press conference and say,
you know, I mean, he's the one really trying to call the shots with that stuff. I mean, sure, Citroen's a partner and whatnot, but he really wants to make a success with that WTCC and his GT cars.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mike W.
Oh, I was just going to say Loeb is just sitting there wanting to call a press conference saying, yeah, you know, these last 9 years, all me. This car really hasn't been all that good, as you can tell.
I think the Citroen was a good car. I think that this year, though, I think it just been a little odd. Yeah, that would be fun. That would be funny. I would laugh. And I would laugh hysterically at that. And I would be like, oh, snap. So, did you have anything else in turn in regards to Mr. Loeb's schedule?
Yeah, not his schedule.
All right. Well, as it said in the show notes, Sebastian Loeb makes everyone else at Pike's Peak look silly. I replaced silly with dumb because it was that much faster than anybody else.
Okay, gentlemen, last year it was entirely paved, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, this year it's entirely paved. Loeb comes and almost puts a minute on last year's record of
He did over a minute. It was a minute and a half.
Oh, my goodness.
But he doesn't have any experience at the mountain. He won't do as well as Millen.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I said. Yeah.
And I told you, I forget who it was that was, I think it was you and I, Shaw, discussing one day on Facebook. I don't think you were necessarily disagreeing. However, I said, if anybody out here is going to go smash that record, I was like, it is the 9-time WRC champion, and Peugeot will destroy that record. I had no doubt in my mind that if the car held together, that's the big thing, because we've seen Marcus Grönholm, his Fiesta. Again, I think that was more to do with the company that provided the car, because that company had a number. I'm serious, because that company, if you look at Kim Block when he was with that company, specifically working on that, on different problems, Kim Block always had equipment issues. Grönholm that year, same company, equipment issue. I don't think it's as much as the driver as it is literally the equipment that they have from that company, the Osberg's people. I think it's a problem within their setting up of the car. That being said, I said that if Loeb goes out there and the whole car holds together, I have no doubt in my mind he's going to destroy I said beat the track record. I said he will set a new record if the car holds together. And not only did he set a new record, he obliterated the record off of the face of the earth.
Like last year's record was like 9:45, and he went, 8:15, something crazy like that. Just ridiculous how different that is. For years, they were trying to break the 10-minute barrier. They finally did it a couple of years ago. And now, you know, you're talking ridiculous 8:15s. So that's nuts.
It was all in. It was all in from Peugeot, and they completely capitalized. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Please speak.
Oh, yeah. Not only was it just such a big domination, you know, one of the things about watching that live feed, which, you know, hats off to Red Bull for helping pull that off, where everybody could watch it live around the world of that run up Pikes Peak. It was just unbelievably fast how fast that car could accelerate. I mean, the all-wheel drive is set up with the twin turbos that Peugeot put on. Oh, my gosh. It was visibly faster than any other car that they showed. It was just unbelievably powerful. And if you watched it, Loeb wasn't doing any corner cutting or anything like that. He was actually playing it really safe, keeping it in the middle of the road. He didn't have to really push it as far as, how he took the corners. He just had to hold on and shift through the gears. I mean, when he was testing the car, he was shocked at how violent, his words, it was to drive that car. It actually took him a little while to kind of get used to it because it was so damn powerful. I mean,
so you're saying he
Loeb
could
say something is violent? That's interesting.
So you're saying with, a little bit of experience under his belt coming back next year, he can shave another 15 seconds off his time pretty easily.
I wouldn't doubt that much. They thought 8:20, or 8:25, you know, from the previous testing that they did and the qualifying. They didn't really realize they'd get down to 8:13 and made it they did. And yeah, Loeb said that, yeah, there's more there.
Yeah, there is. My thing is this, though, because Reese Millen's dad came out and said, when I raced up the mountain, it was all dirt and real men race on the dirt. I'm going to say this for that kind of a time. I think that even if it would have been partially pavement, we're still talking about sub 10 and we're talking world record up the run the way that car went.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, obviously it was set up for what was there, so it's kind of hard to make the comparison. But yeah, wow. Yeah, something I ran across this weekend, I follow a couple of car blogs, and one of them was specifically on like energy efficient green cars. And they had an article on Pikes Peak, and I had to throw it up because I really enjoyed reading through it, talking about how, Mitsubishi put up a car, Monster Tajima and Monster Sport E-Runner, with a final time of 9:46:530. That's extremely close to last year's
finish time. His previous record, where he, when he had broken it, the record, the 10-minute barrier, with his when it still had some dirt on it. So this is Monster's second time running an electric car.
Yeah, you know? I think the car pretty much burnt down last year. But
yeah, it did. It kind of had gone to thermonuclear meltdown.
Nice.
But what's so fascinating about these electric cars is, you know, not only do you have all that torque, but normally, or even these turbocharged engines, as you gain altitude, you lose power. You lose 30% power of the power you had at the start line by the time you get to the finish line.
Yeah.
These cars are starting at, 9,000 feet and ending at 14,000 feet. So, I mean, you're going a mile vertically in very thin air to start with and even thinner air to end.
Gentlemen, I will say that this is a shot across the bow. The electric cars, they are uniquely suited for Pikes Peak because of exactly what you mentioned, Mike. Are we going to see an electric car win overall at Pikes Peak?
I think we're going
to see it in the next 5 years.
Yeah, I think it could easily happen. I don't think that it would happen anywhere else, as was elucidated earlier, you know, but on a 8-minute run, I think an electric car could do it. Now, the one big drawback to an electric car, and if they can solve this issue, then there's no stopping an electric car from taking an overall and setting the record, and that is weight. Weight of the power source, batteries, and weight of the motors. Electric motors are not lightweight. They are very heavy, and very often they're on the hub, so they're unsprung.
Right.
You know, so you solve those two issues, and I look out.
Well, and actually, if you think about it, if you looked at some of the other stuff there, and I don't think it was mentioned necessarily in the article that you had there, Mike, there it is. Yeah, the motorcycle class, a Lightning electric bike. He actually was the overall winner in bikes, and he almost broke the 10-minute barrier on an electric bike.
Dude, that would freak me out trying to drive that.
What is happening right now? Somebody help me.
You know, versus all those Ducatis and guys that, you know, had souped up hardware, he obliterated them on an electric bike. So I think that right there is a telltale sign of what the future may hold.
Very good. Very good indeed. So thus ends another Pikes Peak run. Fantastic stuff from the world's greatest hill climb. Still an event that is on the bucket list for me to attend. I wish I would have been there this year to see Loeb do his thing, but, you know, in due time. And another bit of news, and yet another thing that we talked about, Mike, with Colin, was the fact that Juho Hänninen has been confirmed as Hyundai's test driver.
Yes, indeed. And you know what? I think that's a perfect choice. You know, Colin actually mentioned on Twitter, we were kind of doing this little back and forth the other day when this came out. And, you know, his thing is he doesn't think Juho just has enough experience at the WRC level. Okay, true. He's been stuck at either doing WRC 2 or was in Super 2000. He's done the IRC stuff. He just hasn't had a lot of opportunity in the WRC class.
Yeah.
But my argument is, okay, well, so he'd say, you know, I wouldn't have him as the Hyundai driver for next year. I'd have somebody more experienced and then maybe, you know, some young gun driver that's, you know, up and coming. But the thing is here's Juho's opportunity as a test driver to get so involved. I mean, think of Ogier and all the miles he got on the VW.
Yeah.
He was able to get that car pretty much tuned for him. And that's one reason why it's taking Latvala a little while to get the car where he wanted it. Actually, he didn't start doing well until there was a type of change he could do in the differential, and he couldn't do it until a certain part of the season where it was allowable in the differentials for him to be able to have the settings close for what he liked versus what Ogier liked. And I think this is a similar kind of thing. Juho can have this car help develop it. He's going to get that experience behind that type of a car. He's going to get the, you know, get that time behind the wheel to get it tuned really to his liking. And I think he'd be a great choice. Yeah, I agree with Colin that it's not necessarily he's not a rookie and he's not a super experienced driver than like say a Petter Solberg or a Mikko Hirvonen at the WRC level, but I think he's a great choice.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and you know how I feel about it. I've always said I've thought he's been one of the more underrated drivers, regardless of experience level. To be honest, I think he's been right there, and I think that he really missed out a lot because there was not a lot of opportunities for him to excel and really apply his craft at the highest level because it was only two manufacturers. So read into it what you will, but the fact is he will be testing the Hyundai i20 that is due to hit next year. So woohoo, right?
And he will actually be out at in Finland. I forgot to put this on here. Finland has a record number of entries. It's still another couple weeks away. We're kind of in the you know, summer break right now, but Finland is going to have Juho in a Fiesta.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be driving a Ford for that event, so he's got some sponsorship to drive that one. And Chris Meek, I believe, is going to be there as well.
Yeah,
that's right. He gets a drive in the Citroen. So
yeah,
that's a great opportunity. Actually, Meek himself said this is the best opportunity he's ever had at the WRC level.
Yeah.
Which basically is a smack in the face to Mini, which, of course, you know, their team never developed.
Yeah, half-ass effort then.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how Meek does in the Citroen, especially at Finland. I mean, talk about a guy who's going to be going out there giving everything it is, you know, everything he's got to put together a good finish. And that's a rally, that just requires 100% commitment. And really, as Colin said, balls basically to drive
because
of the speed. So
it does. It's so much commitment there that you've just got to trust your co-driver and you just go 100%. And you know, like he said, I think it was perfect what he said there is that, yeah, Loeb can always win an event that, you know, you have to drive 95-99%. But you have to go 100-110% at Finland. And it's just not a comfortable thing to do. And Loeb does play it a little bit safe. He's a smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually why he wins. And but that's why Finland was always a tough one for him.
Yeah, such commitment. So
in other rally news, we had actually a little over a week ago, we had the third round of the Global Rallycross Championship in Munich at the X Games Munich. They actually did a doubleheader because of the rainout that we ended up having in Spain, which was pathetic because as everybody was tweeting and Facebooking and whatever, it's like, what the hell? These are rally cars. You can't drive in the rain?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of that was track design. These tracks that were done at these X Games, they put them up literally overnight. They were basically hauling a bunch of dirt, which is mostly clay. It doesn't drain very well. And they build the track out of 100% dirt, except for this like 150-yard long or whatever, you know, start-stop, you know, hunk of concrete. That was a starting grid, and everything else was 100% dirt. Out in Munich, they learned. They made a purpose-built track. They brought out some asphalt. They put out gravel. That was actually a combination of chunked up concrete and some gravel mixed together. That gave a good grip. They made mixed with some dirt to make a jump, big tabletop jump. It actually worked really, really well. I've got an article I'll be posting up here shortly with some of the results from that. I believe the first round it was Liam Doran that ended up winning the X Games gold there, yeah. And Ken Block got second after catching up to him. Liam Doran ended up getting a flat tire and had to hold on to it for three laps, but still made it. And then third was Tuomas Häkkinen, who's a really good driver. I can't remember what the second round won that one. I remember that Block got penalized because he bumped somebody when he shouldn't have, yeah. Knocked them out. So, but just in general, my main thing here is that they made the track right. I think they learned from it. They even said that for rain, they're going to start allowing cuts to the tires because they've got a standard tire that they all have to use. Hmm. So if it's an agreement amongst the guys, you know, the officials, that it's wet enough that they need to put cuts in the tires, that they'll allow the teams to do cuts, which is nice. So again, it's a tarmac tire, so you need at least something to get some grip. So that'll make things interesting. So coming up actually this week, on Thursday, kind of an odd night for it, but Thursday night is going to be the first of the Global Rallycross Championship rounds here in the USA. So they're finally coming stateside. They're going to be at New Hampshire Motor Speedway. I pray they make a track like they did at Munich, because that worked really well. It was actually really fun to watch, other than the very last final that they had, because there was a lot of punting going on, and they had to red flag it and restart it multiple times. Yeah. Drivers need to get a little smarter, and I know it's all about the start, but geez. Anyway, so... Yeah, I'm hoping they make a good track. It's also the introduction of this new group. It's a sub-level called the Supercar Lights. It's a single make. They're the Ford Fiestas, but they're less powerful. They're normally aspirated. They still get about 300 horsepower out of them. Mm-hmm. They got the engine in the rear still, though, because that's how it protects them from all the bumping and banging that they do. And there'll be some interesting names that'll come out of that. I haven't seen the full list of drivers who are entering yet. I'll post an article about it when the event happens. But it'll be interesting to see how these younger guys do in competing with that. One of the arguments was whether or not some of the top guys can also race these Supercar Lights. The sucky thing there is you'd end up having like the Nationwide Series with NASCAR. Mm-hmm. And it's where the top level guys, you know, just jump into, you know, those slightly less horsepower cars, you know, and still dominate. And that doesn't make for the best ladder series, you know, in that kind of situation. So anyway, yeah, that's this Thursday. So it'll probably be on the web on ESPN3. They normally have been televising ESPN2 thing, but I'm guessing they're going to bump that to Saturday night. They'll have the event ahead of time and then just replay it on Saturday night. So that's kind of been their thing. Last bit of news, Rally America. Antoine Lestage, he ended up winning, not this last weekend, but the weekend before, the Rally BDC, Bay de Charlet, or whatever it's called up there in Canada. It's all the way up just north of Maine, basically, is where it is. And Antoine Lestage and Natalie Richard, they dominated. Wasn't really, you know, we figured, right?
Yeah.
He dominates up there in Canada. And he's back in the little Evo X, the one that normally has been rented by Rifat Sunkar when he's been here in the States. So he said, though, that he will return to the New England Forest Rally, the next round, which is at the end of July here. So he confirmed he will be there, but he didn't say what car he's going to drive. He did say that it wouldn't be the WRC Lancer.
Huh.
So it's kind of up in the air. What car is he going to drive? He says it's going to be an open class car. He'll be competing at the top level. So nobody knows what this mystery car is that he's going to be driving.
It's an Escort Classic.
That was awesome.
Oh, no, he's going to borrow a classic Group B Quattro.
Now that would be awesome. He's got huge tires on it.
He's going to have Loeb's Pikes Peak car.
Oh, God.
he had Pagano's Pikes Peak car.
Oh, God, the Odyssey.
Oh, the Odyssey. Please yes, stop. Yes, yeah. A little last thing about the Pikes Peak, sure. Simon Pagano takes on Pikes Peak in a minivan.
Oh, my God. Sure, goodness. It has 500
kidding me.
Respect the van.
No, I won't.
There is no respect.
Nice.
Well, wasn't that
the only, the only way I respect the van is if it's black and has a big red strap going up to a spoiler.
Nice. I've been in a boo.
Hey, that van was assembled about 30 miles to my east, gentlemen.
Nice.
By the Honda of Alabama manufacturing plant.
Very nice.
Home of the Honda Odyssey.
Nice. Well, come on out here to Marysville, where they're going to be assembling the new round of NSXs. Oh.
That's a little more exciting.
Anyway. Is that it for rally tonight, then?
That's all we have.
That's it for everything. Yeah, we're 2 hours and 15 minutes into the show.
Shorten up once we remove the dead air.
That's us. Yeah.
Yeah, that's us. You know what?
This is Open Paddock. This is what you get.
Yeah, exactly. you pay such good money for the product, so.
Yeah, that's true.
I just want to say that, you know, it's been a bit long. I appreciate everybody hanging in and everybody listening, especially with all the downloads and everything for the exclusive podcast, the Inside the Helmets we've had, all fantastic responses. I really look forward to this weekend coming up. So next week we'll be talking about Toronto. Do we have an F1? No, we don't have an F1 race. So we will be dealing with Toronto, the double of Toronto. And so, you know, that's obviously going to be a great time. So we will be back here with you next week. So, boys, do you have anything else to say?
We'll be dealing with Toronto and F1 politics, I'm sure.
Oh, yes, I'm sure there'll be.
One always. Quick thing, Mr. Peachin.
Yes.
Are we rally crossing this weekend, this Saturday?
Is it this Saturday? Oh, God, it is this Saturday.
It is this Saturday. So, anyway, the Kansas City region is hosting its second rally cross of the season at a members land there in Paola. Go to motorsportsreg.com and do a search in the Kansas City region for a rallycross. Sign up and come out and join the fun.
Yeah, should be entertaining nonetheless. So.
I'm tempted to take my Outback and do that.
Oh, you should. Nice. I've seen Outbacks out there before, and they do fine.
Yeah, but mine still has a nice paint job.
Nice. I've got about 160 on my Forester, and I would really like to get to 200 without spending too much in maintenance. So I think I'm going to take a cue from Doug's warranty service.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Well, is it under warranty still?
No.
Oh, well, then don't worry about it. Yeah.
It's under. You know what warranty it's under?
The concrete
my
party?
Pocket, my pocketbook.
Oh, okay. Right. Once you hit the concrete
insurance. Yeah, pretty much. Oh, well.
No, what's
very
been
nice.
Making it extra tempting for me is that after the Nameless Rally, a lot of the teams that competed, they're willing to give away some of their slightly used rally tires.
Oh, nice.
And people that are – Doug, you should look into this. They're full-on gravel tires. After any rally event, you should start getting a hold of people because there's a lot of teams that they'll freely give them away, especially for people that that come out and help. You know, someone like me that's going out there and volunteering. You know, we're going through those nasty roads with our road tires, and it can be kind of dangerous. So they're willing to give them away.
I'll have to go talk to our friends at Four Boys Racing.
Yes.
There you go.
So,
maybe Mr. Right, Bonds can hook me up.
There we go. Well, that's all we have this week, everybody. I just want to say thanks so much for listening, and we will be back with you here next week, same time, same channel, talking about Toronto and, as Mike said, Formula One politics. So until next time, everybody, have a good night.